Blog Talk Radio.
Heavenly mothers crying, see the children are dying at the hands of the other child. Her heart is breaking, feel the earth is shaking, but rivers flow from the tears she cries. She cries, she cries, Rachel's weeping for her children.
Rachel's weeping,
somehow someone's got to save them.
Save the children.
And if you say that
good evening and welcome to Heart Talk with Miss E. Wow, it's been a while since I've been here, since you've heard my voice, since I've heard my voice, hearing your voice. It has been quite an eventful summer. And so for the whole month of July, you did not hear from me unless you went back and listened to some of the old archives. And the last time we spoke was actually in June when we had our guest, Ms. Leslie Class Hernandez, or Hernandez Class, with the Learning Curves Careers. Oh, gosh, there's so much that has happened. And tonight's program is really, I think, very appropriate given what I've been through personally and what our nation is sort of reeling from following the loss of one of, I think, probably most of our favorite comedian, one of our favorite comedians, Mr. Robin Williams. And knowing that him having been reported to have taken his own life following issues related to depression and substance abuse, people are finding it very difficult to understand how is it that someone with so much laughter and so much talent and so much energy come to the place where he could not find that smile within himself. So tonight's program is entitled Laughing to Keep from Crying. And that's maybe a term that some of you may have heard. I grew up hearing that and just said, oh, I'm laughing to keep from crying. You know, you ever laugh at something that's just so ridiculous? It's like it's so painful, but you just don't want to cry at the time. And some people have been extremely gifted to take something that would be ordinarily painful and debilitating and turn it into humor. However, at the same time, we all are human beings. And we are prone to moments of sadness, moments of frustration, moments of devastation. However, the key is how to get back up. And our guest tonight is a prime example of that very thing. She herself, being a comedian and embracing the gift of laughter, found herself in a situation where she felt that it was over, or she at least wanted it to be over. Our guest tonight is none other than Ms. Marsha Woodland, also known as Comedian Miss Woody. She is the founder of Midwest Show, Me Funny Entertainment, and organizer of the nationwide, it is a nationwide program titled the Midwest Show Me Funny Comedy Festival, which features comedians from throughout the U.S. Their mission is to build a better community using comedy as a healing source, and their goal is to help heal through laughter. So you can read the rest of her accolades and a little bit more of her life story, but at this moment, we're going to give her the opportunity to talk about it, and she is going to have a heart talk with Miss E. Miss Woody, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I am doing great. So glad to have you and glad that you accepted our invitation to be on this call tonight. And you know a little about, I will say a little bit, you know a lot about both sides of this conversation, the laughter and the crying and the in-between, the laughing to keep from crying.
Oh, yes, I can definitely say I am the voice right now for many of those that are on both sides of the fence as far as comedy and wanting to do comedy, the struggles of not having the support and just dealing with depression. I can definitely speak on that.
Okay. So I do know that there is a story, and we're going to sort of gradually sort of creep up on that. But first of all, tell us about your love for comedy. And one of the things that is shared on your website is that the first inspiration for you for doing comedy. Tell us about that.
Well, my first opportunity to do comedy was at a local comedy club that most of the people in the African-American community went to. Was a place called Sanford's. And out of Sanford's roles, Cedric the Entertainer, Lavelle Crawford, the Torrey Brothers, you know, everyone from St. Louis or grew up in St. Louis had to step on stage at Sanford's. And that was one of the first places that I tried doing comedy. Loved it.
Wow. And you said one of the memorable events was when Cedric Entertainer actually used you for the subject of his stand-up that night.
Oh, yes. Well, I would say that wasn't the time that captured my attention, that took hold of me and said, hey, this is what you have to do. I was doing some comedy at a venue, and Cedric happened to be there. He had already, you know, been doing comedy for a while. His name was just climbing up the ladder. But it was a memorable moment for me because he took time out to talk to me and tell me, keep going. He said, you were funny. And that meant so much to me because I was already feeling the little bite. And I just had to just do this thing. And the next time I saw him on some comedy, and he used me as a subject, and I was like, you know, I'm going to get him back one day. I'm going to get an opportunity to get him back. I have not had that opportunity yet, but if you listen, Cedric, comedian is what he got one for you. I went to college with him, so he inspired me in college. Yeah.
Wow. And where did you attend?
I went to Southeast Missouri State University.
All right. I'm curious, what was your major?
Well, I minored in law, and I was majoring in electrical engineering, but I couldn't finish because I had a daughter at a young age taking calculus classes every morning and hitting those heels and dealing with child care and school. I couldn't do it. I couldn't keep going. And when I came home, they couldn't handle it, so I had to leave.
Okay, but your major was electrical engineering.
Yes, I was a major in electrical engineering and I minored in law. So those were the type of classes that I was taking.
So I was going to say that's a far stretch from being comedic, but I'm sure you can find the as they say, the ha-ha in that. So were you a kid that people told was funny as you were growing up?
Yes, I was. I was the type of kid that could use my creative thoughts to get out of trouble or switch the tension back to another child. I was
deflect it to keep yourself out of trouble.
Oh yeah, that's an engineering mind. You know, that's basically what engineering is. It's the way to figure things out. You know. And I was good at it.
Okay. So there was a little strategy in that.
Yes.
What was your first actual comedy performance or gig? And what do you remember most about it?
Well, the first gig, I remember being so nervous and scared And I went up on stage to do like 3 minutes, and I probably did maybe 40 to 50 seconds, and I was out of there. And I remember saying, I got to do it again. And I went back, tried it again. Next time I did 3 minutes. The time after that, I did 5 minutes, and I was getting peached at that time. The peach.
So what was it that you enjoyed most about it?
What I enjoyed most about it was the challenge. I've always been the type of person that welcomes a challenge. So the challenge of getting up there time after time, and the times were very far apart. So it wasn't like I was chasing the stage every week, you know, two or three times a week. It was pretty far. So the next challenge, when it came about, it was like, okay, I'm going to step there. I'm going to challenge myself to do it more than what I did the last time. And that's what it was. It was the challenge.
Huh. So where did you gather most of your content from? You know, are you a storyteller? Are you, just looking at situations and telling it from a different perspective, or just your imagination?
Well, one thing about being a comedian, you have to play around with it before you find where you fit in. And for me, being a prop comic is what works for me. And because of my creativity.
Can you explain to our audience and to me as well what a prop comic is?
Okay. A prop comic is someone that uses items to enhance the joke. Okay? For example, me having a lot of children. I have a lot of children, and I get a lot of my inspiration from my children. So to answer that question, I will touch on a subject that people can relate to. With me having so many children, I talk about having so many children and pull out one of my props that will make you laugh. And you should visualize this prop. It's a super-sized birth control pack. Now, I have 9 children, so just imagine a super-sized birth control pack. And if you're not a comedian, you can surely think of something funny to say beyond what I just said.
just the visuals of looking at that. Okay, it's big, and obviously you didn't use it.
No, did not work.
Okay. So I'm sure there's stories behind that as well. And who do you see as being the most of your audience? Really drawn to your humor?
Anybody can relate to my humor because it's basically touching on everyone's life. I've practiced my craft with little babies to the oldest person I've ever met. And I think the oldest person I've ever met was like 105 or 6 years old and sharp mind. So I will try my comedy out with anyone just to see if I still have it. And I do.
Okay, so are you one of the people that just walk up to someone on the street and start talking to them?
Well, I will. And for me, comedy, there's a time and a place for everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that person that's always looking for a laugh. I try that. I'm past that. But I will do whatever I can do to make you laugh. If I find you in a very sad mood, I will first talk you into the conversation to lure you into laughter, because I want to do what I have to do to change your mindset. And that's, I'm very good at that.
So that was something that you were already sensitive to people's moods and sadness and depression. And so that was a part of your intent, was to lift people's heaviness.
Yes.
Okay. So now, prior to the event that we're going to talk about, that was the pivotal point in your personal life, had you ever experienced depression or any other type of mental health challenges or anxiety prior to the incident that we're going to talk about next?
No, no one in my family had.
Okay. And you yourself, you had never experienced depression?
No.
Okay. So you were just sensitive to it and picking it up from others, but had never really gone through that yourself?
No, I had never gone through depression. It was,
okay.
So
the event that really was the crucial point in your life was actually at your workplace, which is really the whole backdrop for your projects that you are working on and having completed. And I just want to say congratulations for your
Thank you.
Documentary being accepted by the St. Louis Black Film Festival.
Yes, I'm so excited.
Yes, yes. And tell us the title of that.
The title is called The Day I Almost Went Postal. And I came up with the title. I know it makes you laugh, right? But it also makes you think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
And it was actually, just the irony of it that it actually occurred in the postal service. That was your
yes.
place of employment.
Yes, it was, for almost 16 years.
Wow. So leading up to that particular day, which you'll be able to tell the audience, had you experienced, had there been stressors leading up to the incident?
Well, there was some, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, what I would say is there were signs once I started complaining about a work-related injury. I had to have surgery for carpal tunnel syndrome. So that process took a while from the beginning of complaining of the pain up into the day of the incident was 2 years.
Wow.
So the pain was increasing, and, most people don't know that when you're dealing with a lot of pain, it increases the stress, the depression.
Right.
And dealing with pain on top of it, and everything changing from what you're used to, that's heavy on your mind.
Right.
And it's very sensitive, and, people don't really think about it, that the depression's, you can get severely depressed from dealing with just pain.
Yes, indeed, because the serotonin levels that would normally go to buffer your brain to keep your mood up is all going toward trying to buffer the pain. And actually, I experienced that myself last year at going through some very serious back and leg pain, and it was just overwhelming. And people don't realize our body chemistry changes, because even my blood pressure was up. I started getting depressed and more, and it was pretty scary. And I'm a therapist. And that was like, wow. And then it took me a while to sort of come out of myself and my pain to sort of tap into my knowledge and say, oh, my gosh, this is what's happening to me. Yeah, so I think when people are talking about pain and family members are really impatient with their ability to get up and do something, and so if you moved around, you might feel better, but they don't understand that it's all tied in together. So that's absolutely correct. And so with that, you had had surgery, and you were back at work. And so tell us what happened on the day that you almost went postal.
Well, on the day that, it wasn't that point when I almost went postal, but I had only had the first surgery. If anyone out there can relate to carpal tunnel pain, it's the type of pain that makes you want to chop your hands off. And I had just had the first surgery, and I was in a cast. So at that point, I was actually trying to retrieve back pay. And because I had called over the supervisor's head, over and over again, this was a problem. But at that point, I had started losing everything. My utilities were shut off. I lost my car. It was so many things. I had lost my car. I had lost everything. So I just could not handle. I couldn't handle it. Couldn't handle it.
Mhm.
And that was devastating to me.
Mhm. And so there was a point when you required assistance, you required mental health services. So tell us about the incident.
I'm sorry.
I said there was a point that you required mental health services and were hospitalized. Tell us about the incident that led to that.
Okay, well, when the supervisor approached me with the EpiPen, she was very close to my face the first time, and I knew from her approach something was going on because she and I normally get along, even though I was seeing the signs of them treating me differently because of me reporting this work-related injury. So the second time she came around, she was in my face. She was even closer to my face, and she was standing over me, and I was sitting down, and she got so close, she actually stuck me in my eye. And
ouch.
When I knocked the pen out of her hand, when I knocked the EpiPen out of her hand, she ran through the building, and she was looking around as if to see if someone was, you know, had saw her, and she was yelling, "Somebody call the post inspector. She hit me. She hit me." And I'm looking like, "I didn't hit you. You just stuck me in the eye." So it was shocking to me, although I've seen little setups over the years, or what seemed to be a setup before they got rid of someone, and I couldn't handle it. I knew it was going to be her word against mine, so I ran into the ladies' room, and I had the pain pills in my pocket, and I took the pain pills out and took all of them. I just wanted it to be over. I just wanted everything to be done because I had lost everything, losing it, the rest of the little things that I had. And I was always in control. I always had things done my way because I didn't really depend on anyone. I've always worked.
Uh-huh.
Always worked and took care of my business, and everything was just spiraling down fast.
Wow. So that was the first time anything like that had ever crossed your mind, and the first time that you just impulsively just did that and took the pills.
Yes, that was the first time that I actually did it. But up to that day, I had thought about it. I had thought about it, but I never actually accomplished it until that day.
Broken camel's back.
Yeah, that was the first time.
Okay. I guess they called paramedics. They came and got you, took you to the hospital, pumped your stomach.
Yeah, I was out. I was out because the pain pills were so strong. And by the time they found me in the bathroom and then called the ambulance, and by the time I got to the hospital, I passed out. I was out. And
okay.
I spent about a week in the psych ward, and then being in the psych ward was like, whoa, this is an experience. Like I was depressed, but I was sane, and I was thinking, how could I be in this position? Not knowing that my depression was getting worse as that time went on.
Wow.
But I found a new respect. I found a new respect for people with mental illness.
Okay.
That's when I started respecting people with mental illness.
Wow. So what was it that sort of became that newfound respect for you, that eye-opener?
Because I was in that hospital with people who were cutters. Matter of fact, my roommate, she was a cutter. And I found her in a room with a plastic fork that she had taken from the breakfast room, and she was cutting her wrist.
Uh-huh.
And I said, it's just me. I don't want to be this person. But I still wasn't convinced that I was not going to do this again or try to do this again. At that moment, I wasn't thinking that.
Uh-huh.
But I had a respect for those that were, you know, a little bit more ill than me. But yet I was still in that category.
Right. And you felt the pain.
I felt the pain.
You felt the pain. So now you're in a position where you couldn't just sort of laugh it off or turn away from it. It was right there in your face because you realized that you were so close, that you really had something in common. It was just a different depth or a different level at that point.
Yes. Well, by this point, I hadn't done comedy for several years because I was focused on work. I was away from comedy. I still was that comic person, that comedic person, but I wasn't doing stand-up because the job was so demanding. Delivering mail was, a number of hours a day, and then I was working another job at night driving for our transit company because I had another project, which was a house. It was a house that I had bought, and I had put like $70,000-$80,000 worth of work into this house. So whenever I started a project, that's just how I am. When I start a project, I have to see it to the end. So that's why I had the hiatus from comedy and focused on family, bringing my family up, and I had a lot of children. So,
you know, it's interesting to me that, my motto is, to follow your heart, heal your heart and follow it. And it seems that most times when people get somewhat off path in terms of following their heart, there's usually something that comes and shakes that foundation. And even though it can be very painful, even though it can be very uncomfortable, it brings you back to that place where you end up looking back at your heart again. And it sounds like that's what happened to you in that process.
Yes, it is.
Wow.
It is.
Now, in the midst of all of that, were you able to find any humor in any of the scenarios? Because I know people say, you know, it's a fine line between pain and humor. And I think a lot of comedians, walk that edge very, very closely. And I think it depends on what side of it you're on, whether you find someone's humor to be humorous. But I think at the same time, that's the way some people actually cope with the pain, that if they can find, the madness in a situation, they're able to laugh at it. Did that kick in for you while you were in that state?
Well, while I was in that state of mind, well, I'm going to go back to prior, before all of this had happened. This is how I coped with the job itself, because the job was so demanding, dealing with management. I laughed everything off, and it was like one foot in front of the other. And I was that person that kept everybody happy at work. If someone started arguing, I would intervene with something silly to distract the other person from, taking it to that next level. I smoothed the surface, so I got along with everybody in the building. I didn't have no enemies in the building, none. But when it came to after the altercation and all of that, I wasn't thinking on the lines of making anybody laugh. Matter of fact, I used to say this when I came to work every day. I love this place. I love this place. But when this started happening to me, one of my coworkers said, "Hey, Woody, how you feel about this place now?" And I said, "I hate this place. I hate this place." And they would laugh at my expense. And I would try to, chuckle with them. So I was still that comedian, but I was hurting.
Yes.
Nothing was funny at that time.
Right. And it was no longer Uncovering the Pain. And it's interesting because when I came up with the title for tonight's show, it was, you know, are you laughing to keep from crying? But the second part of that, are you dying laughing? You know how you get so tickled, you people say, oh, I was dying laughing. And when we think of, I'm one that's really keen on words and being careful about what we speak, but sometimes I think you might be laughing on the outside and dying on the inside, so you're dying laughing. So I think that actually I took it off, but now that I'm talking to you, I think that would be probably very appropriate, that you were dying laughing, and then your laughter died. So there was that part of you on the inside that was feeling just helpless, hopeless. Wow.
Oh, yes.
Now, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Pardon me?
No, I was gonna say right after the hospital stay, when I returned back to work, is at the point when I almost went postal. So I was basically getting back to your earlier question.
Okay.
What pushed me to that point where I almost went postal, if you want me to explain that part?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, when I returned back to work, the supervisor that had stuck me in the eye came back to work the day after me, and I still had the other hand that needed to be done as far as the surgery. Because I was on light and limited duty, and everyone was talking about what had happened, how could I try to take my life, not the person that made everybody laugh? How could she do this? You know, why would she do this? Some people even said to me, why didn't you just punch her in the face, you know? But I wasn't a violent person. That wasn't me. So management, the manager of the station, called me into the office and told me that I was keeping everyone from working because everybody was talking about it. It was buzz. It was buzz throughout the whole city of St. Louis who had heard about it. They worked for the post office.
Wow.
Somebody tried to kill herself because a supervisor stuck her in the eye. You know, that's big talk.
Yeah.
They made me sit in the office directly in front of the same lady that stuck me in the eye with the E-pen.
Oh, my goodness.
And
oh,
I had to
my
do it. The
wow.
choice was you either do your life duty here or be it out. For one, my transportation was taken from me, and I was walking to work, and I had to start back punching the clock in order to get a check, and they were in control of that. So if I didn't take it, I had to clock out. Therefore, I wouldn't have any money for my family, and I was already trying to bounce back from having the first surgery, and they hadn't even finished or even got started on the paperwork for my back pay, and it was a lot of money that they owed me.
Wow.
I could have saved my utilities, my bills, my home. Eventually, I lost all that.
Wow.
So at that moment is when I was ready to go postal because it was to the point where, do I want to hit her with this? Do I want to stab her with this? Do I want to, you know, this was for a whole month that I had to go to work and look this woman in her face and her doing anything she could do to annoy me, tapping on the desk, humming, kicking the trash can. But when I would do it, I was told I better stop or they were going to clock me out.
Wow, so that was really abuse.
Yeah, mental abuse, intimidation.
Were you in therapy during this time? And
I
guess
I just started therapy.
Okay, so when you were in the hospital, how long did you stay in the hospital?
I was in the hospital for 3 days.
Okay.
And
they placed you on medication?
Yes.
So what type of service did they provide for you while you were hospitalized?
Well, I had a number of different medications that they put me on over the course of those years until I stopped taking the medication. But first they had me on, I was on Abilify, I was on Paxil, and what else was I on? I was even on Defa for a while. And shortly after that, I tried suicide again. and I was on, what was it, Clazepam or something like that. And one of them, they took me off of it because they thought that that was the reason why I was still thinking suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't the reason. It was the mental abuse that I was continuously dealing with.
And the stress.
I was forced in that position. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So while you're in this dilemma, do I hit her, do I stab her, do I slap her? What came about at that particular time?
I cried every day. My coworkers would do everything from come and rub me on my back to give me a Bible. Because they witnessed this happen. This was not only happening to me, it was happening to them. Because they were sitting here watching this, and most of them were feeling helpless because in a position like the Postal Service, if you lean toward the person who is targeted, then you become a target.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a problem. But we had a few people that stood up for me, and they didn't like that.
Yeah, and that really falls into the category, you know, of bullying, you know, social casting, that basically our children experience. We all experience it to some extent in many types of institutions or environments, and I think there are so many people who feel that sense of non-acceptance, that sense of rejection, that sense of being sabotaged. And unfortunately, a lot of this starts in people's home environments, and then it extends to school, to college, to work, to the community. So in all of these stresses, plus the need to be able to take care of your own finances and well-being, and God forbid that you have a family to take care of. So this was gradually mounting for you. And, you know, and I always tell people, even though I'm in the field of mental health, I don't necessarily buy every theory that I studied. However, one of those that I do that stands out that says that basically depression is anger turned inward. And anger really is a secondary emotion, which really is a more powerful emotion over the hurt, the disappointment, and the more vulnerable feelings. So when we're feeling vulnerable and we are angry, if we turn it in on ourselves, that's where the depression comes from. That's where the suicidal actions and gestures came from. And then when you turn it out, it's like towards someone else. So you were vacillating back and forth what to do with this anger, which was really what to do with your pain. And I think a lot of times we don't feel like we have options. And I think one of my greatest jobs in my work as a therapist is helping people to, one, to acknowledge and validate their feelings, for someone to listen to them, and then to find a plan of action to move on them. And you were feeling stuck. And that's what a lot of our society is feeling, just stuck. And that sense of depression becomes that black cloud that hangs over the saying, yeah, nothing is going to happen after this. Nothing good is going to come of this. You might as well just, you know, get up on out of here. And that saddens me. It saddens me. And, you know, as a Christian, you know, I believe the scripture, and it says, be careful, because in the end, even the very elect would be deceived. And I don't think that just means spiritually or religiously. I think it means even in terms of knowing who we are and whose we are, we get caught because that heaviness, the depression can be so debilitating. We forget who we are, we forget whose we are, and we forget why we are here. But fortunately, you found your why. So what did it take for you to bounce back and to start your organization?
Well, it took my therapist who talked me into getting back into comedy. She said, at least start writing, you know.
Okay.
So use what you experienced and make a joke out of it.
Okay.
I was like, whatever, you know.
So
I'm just hurting.
He must have had some pretty enjoyable sessions with you so that he tapped into your humor. So I'm sure that you probably humored him a lot in your sessions.
Well,
is that where he caught
because
it?
Because they, you know, tried to diagnose me with bipolar, and I knew I wasn't bipolar because I was,
mm-hmm.
like I said, I was naturally a humorous person. So
mm-hmm.
when they finally got me diagnosed with the right diagnosis of being generalized anxiety, having generalized anxiety disorder, then he could talk to me in a way that related to my diagnosis. So
okay.
when he suggested that I thought back doing writing, and he challenged me, because I always said I welcome the challenge. So he said, I'm going to challenge you. The next time you come to see me, I want to hear a joke. I want to hear a joke. And
wow.
I came back. I didn't have a joke. And he's like, well, you disappointed me. So next time you come back, I'm going to challenge you again. I'm going to hear a joke. And I made sure I had a joke for him. And before I knew it, I was writing again. And that was helping me. But then I had another blow. My children's father passed away. So I was hurting them, you know.
Wow.
And then the post office forced me out. You know, that was another blow. Every time I mm-hmm. tried to get back into writing, there was something else keeping me stuck.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. In that state. But I had to get back into writing.
Mm-hmm.
I had to get back into writing. Keep writing, keep writing.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to use the things that you were dealing with on a day-to-day basis in your writing?
Yes, I did, because I had troubled relationships. And one thing about people dealing with depression, I suggest they don't start a relationship. And that was
okay.
my problem. I had a few relationships which... I end up having children with those relationships, and I actually call my last three children my depressed children, because I was severely depressed when I had those children, and I didn't take time out to heal fully before
mm-hmm.
getting into another relationship, because I was hurting so bad, because the one thing that I loved was taken from me, and that was my job. I love my job.
Mm-hmm.
You're married to your work. Yeah, you're married to your work. I was actually married to my work.
Mm-hmm.
I love my job. I love pleasing the customers and being that good carrier, bringing their mail, you know, bringing them joy, bringing them bills that they didn't want to see. You know? But I was good at what I did, you know, and they commended me for that.
So you liked the interaction as well.
Yes, I did.
Really? What was your family's take on it? Your family of origin, your children, your mates, how did they respond to this totally different side of you that they were now seeing?
Well, I was the strong one in the family. I was amongst cousins, you know, sister, brother. I was the one that could handle it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was taking care of my bills. I was the one that anybody could come to when they need to borrow money. I was just the go-to person. And now
mm-hmm.
here I am appearing as the weak link.
Mm-hmm.
And all I heard was, snap out of it. Get yourself together. Oh, you tripping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are the things that I heard. And I knew I was drowning.
Yes. 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 So people don't know how to respond, and that just makes things even just more dismal, because you feel like nobody understands. But it's awesome that you had a therapist that understood. And a lot of times when we tell people, you know, recommend that they go to therapy, people feel like nobody can understand and there's nothing they can do to help me. What would you say to the person who is used to being the one to take care of everyone else and all of a sudden feel like they can't take care of their own needs emotionally or otherwise? What would you say to them about finding a therapist?
I would say to them, find a therapist that they feel is actually listening to them. Because if you therapists are people too. They have issues. They have things on their mind. They could be distracted. You have to find someone who is actually listening. And I'm not talking about just from writing the notes. I'm talking about getting into the conversation and you feeling that vibe that they understand you.
Yes.
Just because they're a therapist and they're talking to you doesn't mean they really understand you. You have to get – it's just like a personal relationship with a mate or a family member or a child. You know who you're closest to.
Mm-hmm.
If you got several sisters or brothers or whatever, you know who you're closest to. You know that person that you can call upon, and they're going to actually listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
So you call upon that person. That's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was
saying. That's very important, how to find a good match or a good fit. I remember one time being assigned to a therapist through Kaiser, and I went, and I realized two times in a row I left there and I sat in the car and cried for like 20 minutes after. And finally I said, wait a minute, this is stupid. This is not helping, except for if it was releasing some. And I actively began to seek another therapist and found one that was, you know, just as perfect of a match as I'd ever had. And it's like, wow, what a difference a person makes. And so it's really important that I think that someone is up front, too, and says, you know, I'm not feeling real comfortable with this, and be able to understand why. Is it because you feel like you're not being heard? I know for me, one, wondering if it was cultural or ethnic, because everything I said, the lady asked me to explain that. And it's like, okay, I know I'm somewhat bilingual, but I don't think I'm talking, you know, that, you know, much colloquialism that she can't understand what I'm saying. And I found that frustrating. It's like, come on, just feel me, lady, feel me. And that was one issue that I had. I had another that was telling me what to do that was totally against my value system. She didn't even know me, and it was about caring for my developmentally disabled sibling. So as a caregiver, we all get tired. We all just start to feel drained. But she told me that to put my sister in a home. Talk about wanting to slap somebody.
No.
So, yeah,
I was going to say, I had one tell me that I better not have any more children.
Wow.
Like, what? I'm like, what? Why would you even say that to me? Oh, you better not have any more children. I'm like,
wow, you just said, okay, somebody made you God. You know, and even if they felt that way, that wasn't the appropriate thing to be saying to someone that's going to help. Like, how is that supposed to help? Yeah, and I think what is difficult is when someone is in that depressed state and you've got someone that's in a position that's supposed to be helpful that you have some regard for, and then you feel like they let you down or they abuse you even more. That's very difficult. So I would say to anyone that if you're feeling more abused and more hurt and more distraught after going to a therapy session, keep looking. Just don't give up. There's somebody out there for you. Ask friends. You know, I think now it's not as hush-hush and shameful for people to say, I have a therapist. I know one of the parents of one of my teenage clients said, you know, this is becoming a status symbol now. If you ask the child, you know, well, how come you can't go? Oh, I have to go see my therapist. So I think it's a good thing that we can be open and share what's going on with ourselves to give other people that sense of freedom. And so as you're talking about your pain and how that pain didn't cover up, I think people are still struggling, you know, with how could Robin Williams, you know, the one who brought joy to everyone, cover it up. Sometimes things just become a habit or a way of life, and sometimes you just need to refuel. And if you're the one doing the refueling all the time, you know, how do you get refilled? What do you need to do? and who can really understand you? And I think we just have to continue to reach out. That happens with caregivers, with providers, with therapists, anyone that's in a position that's considered to be of high regard or authority or significance in our lives. And we, like you said, everyone is human. I think when we spoke before the call, I had shared an experience with you, and you said, you know, you had to stop me right there because it was the same experience your therapist had had. And one of the things I was sharing, that some who may be listening are aware, that I just returned to work last week after being off for 3 weeks following a series of deaths. I had three deaths in the month of July and one in June, and it was just so overwhelming to me. I just couldn't even move forward, and the one that got me the most was a young man that I had known since he was a little boy. He was only in his 20s. I just spoke to him. He died of a drug overdose, and for me, that was like suicide, and it shook me to my very core, and it was like, okay, I don't know if I can go back and talk to anybody right now. And I realized I needed to sort all those mixed emotions that were going on. And I think being honest and being authentic with who you are and leading by example. And I just told clients, I said, you know, I'm practicing what I teach. I need time out. When I tell you to take time out, I'm not telling you to do something that I wouldn't do. And then you share that your therapist had a similar situation.
Yes. It was hard because this person was there for me, and he had a loss. He lost a child, and he was giving up.
Uh-huh.
Right at the time when he was seeing my children, when their dad had passed. He got me to the point where I was feeling better about myself. I was still fighting the case, but I was feeling better at that point, fighting the case. And then the kid's dad passed away. And then shortly after that, his child died. His only child.
So oh, my gosh.
That was hard for him. And he was giving up, you know, being a therapist. And my children, being who they are, they're a lot like me. And they're creative. They're artists, and he was back in our life again. Basically, we helped each other.
They're all
in college and all of that, high school and college now, and they were little kids. They were like at the age of 7, 8. So he saw me for years, and then ended up seeing the children after me. Mm-hmm. So we have a long history.
Mm-hmm. And that's a true therapeutic relationship. And we talk about being dependent on people, but we're really interdependent. And I know people in the field or in the profession would probably say, you know, well, the client is never supposed to be your therapist. But I think people miss the concept. You know, I always talk about, you know, working from the heart. We all have hearts, and we feed off of one another in a healthy way. And so when we give life, when we give our hearts, that's reciprocated. And we're not talking about, you know, going out and doing financial things or doing things that are totally unethical, but just being present, touching someone's heart and allowing your own heart to be touched. That's what resuscitation is. That's what healing our hearts is. That's what moving forward is all about. So I'm, you know, just really pleased to know that there's some practitioners out there that are really allowing their hearts to be touched as they touch others. That is beautiful. So this time is going by very quickly. Tell me and tell our audience a little bit about your organization. At what point did you start that, and all of the things, especially in regards to people with mental illness and homelessness, how this organization came into place?
Well, first of all, when I took it, United States Postal Service to federal court, they immediately started with me, and I took the money and invested in my future and my children's future by becoming a promoter. I knew I couldn't chase the stage as a comedian because of the ages of my children and the time it takes to, you know, to build your name as a successful comedian. So I used the art and the gift that God gave me to make people laugh, to not only tell my story, but use it to have events so I can pay it forward. And what I'm currently working on now is a comedy festival, and I'm using the contestants from the comedy festival to be the cast members for my movie that I'm writing and my stage play.
And tell us the name of the movie.
The name of the movie is called Certified Crazy. And I came up with that title because of two reasons. It's a lot of craziness going on at the post office. And I'm sure you all have received a certified letter or two in your time. And when people are seeing people walking around and they're walking around in a coat in 100-degree weather, they'll look at that person and say, oh, he must be crazy. Oh, she must be crazy. Now, when you hear somebody telling a really funny joke, or you know someone that's very humorous, and when you see them and they're cracking you up, and first thing you say, oh, you're crazy. Oh, that was so crazy. Oh, no, he's crazy. So I use those words in one, and that's how I came up with the title.
You know, wow.
Certified Crazy. Actually, the guy who helped me with the documentary came up with the first title of Certified, and I added the crazy to it, and it just worked. Certified Crazy. And it's a comedy movie. It's a comedy movie about the postal workers, so it'll be a cast of comedians playing postal workers. So I'm doing all I can to raise the funds so we can film and, you know, possibly get some well-known comedians in there, but I mainly want the cast to be unknown, discovered talent, comedians that, you know, very few of us know.
Up-and-coming actors and actresses. And the proceeds from these endeavors will serve to do what in the community?
Well, from my portion of the project, because I'm collaborating with comedy promoters across the United States, our goal is to collaborate with up to 100 comedians. Comedians that promote, each one will support their own cause, the cause that's closest to their heart. And the proceeds from my portion, which will be the finals, and I'm trying to raise enough money to rent a stadium. And if we have, you know, a big name like maybe Kevin Hart or somebody like that to host, I'm sure we can fill it to capacity. Especially since we're doing it to raise awareness and raise money for homelessness and mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's dear to my heart.
Awesome, awesome. Tell our listeners where they can find you on the Internet, on Facebook, and in your email address.
Okay, my website is Midwest Show Me Funny Entertainment. You can Google me under my name, Marshall Woodland, or comedian Miss Woody. My email address is marshallwoody@yahoo.com, and that's marshallewoody@yahoo.com. Again, the website is Midwest Show Me Funny Entertainment. I also have a support group on Facebook, and it's under Comedy Festival Collaboration, and I have a separate group which is for the community only. If someone out there that is a promoter that would like to represent their state, you can check out my website and see if your state is in need to be represented. Then you can send me a message either by my website, join the support group, or simply give me a call. I like to talk to people. You know, most people don't want to talk too much these days, but I really love getting the passion from someone's voice. And my phone number is 314-243-6034, 314-243-6034. And together we're all trying to help and heal through laughter, and especially here in St. Louis. With all the mess that's going on, we really need to focus on trying to help and heal behind all of this pain.
Yes, 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 indeed. Do you have any tidbit from any of your stand-up that you would like to share with us this evening? Any thoughts?
Any thoughts? Well, basically, I summed it all up. We really need to learn to laugh. We really need to enjoy life. When you're talking to people and you can see that they're troubled, or even when you're in a mood, you know, do something that can bring you out of that mood, or someone else that's in the mood that, you know, we're all the comics. One thing about people, we're all funny, but to be a comedian, it requires a skill. So enjoy life, you know. Mm-hmm. Keep the funny. If you got some funny, you know.
Well, being being the visual person, because I am the visual person. I would have been the kid that you got in trouble in school. Actually, ninth grade algebra teacher, my sixth grade class, wrote in my yearbook to Evelyn, the girl who could laugh for days. Sometimes he'd just look at me and just look at the door as if to say, just go out until you can get yourself together. I've always loved to laugh. I had a best friend who sat in the front row in our English class and would always be saying this, and I'm cracking up, and the teacher says, Evelyn, why can't you be like your friend? And she didn't realize my friend was the one that was cracking the jokes. I'm the one that's just curled up in a ball laughing. And I can think of things, and I can just see a picture, and I start to laugh. So leave us with a visual that we can hold on to that can maybe bring us some funny that we can think of when we think about Ms. Woody.
Okay, this one that almost everyone can relate to. I won't say everyone, but everyone knows about roaches. And I would tell people, I was just I just blurted out, hey, do you have roaches? You know, look at me like, roaches? It's like, hey, I bet you my roaches are nothing like your roaches. I discovered my roaches wouldn't die because they were wearing army fatigue, gas masks with picket signs.
Okay.
Just a visual. Just picture a roach with army fatigue cape with a gas mask, holding a picket sign saying, we're not going anywhere.
Okay, we will not die. We will not die. Okay. And something for those who don't particularly relate to the roaches.
All I can tell you is life is a joke. To me, I'm just enjoying life, you know. I'm not going to call it a joke to say, you know, life is, you know, it's nothing. But I look at the way things are going now, the timing of my documentary being accepted, the timing of Robin Williams' death, and what I'm doing, this project I've been working on for over 12 years. I say, God has to be a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up with the title and the way I deliver the message of this project, and I make people laugh. But the message is, use laughter to live. Use laughter to live. You know, humans, you need humor to get through. As a human, humanity, you know, the word is right there in the word. Humor, humanity. We need it. We need the laughter.
Right.
You feel good when you laugh. You forget about everything when you laugh.
When we look at that, it's balance. Sometimes we need to cry, and sometimes, as the Bible says, for everything there's a season, a time to laugh, a time to cry. And I think allowing ourselves to just go with the flow. And sometimes people say, oh, I'm feeling, you know, just all over the place because one minute I'm laughing and one minute I'm crying. That's the grieving process. And if you just let the body do what it needs to do without trying to fit it into some little box in a time frame in which we start to heal from the trauma that we all experience on some level or the other, it's very, very, very important. And so I believe in taking time to do both. And I always tell people that that's when the laughter, you know, when you die laughing because you try to laugh over rather than acknowledging the pain. We have to acknowledge the pain, be with it. We don't have to stay stuck in it, but and we do not have to define ourselves by the pain, but just to acknowledge that it's there and look at this too shall pass. And how do you get through it? How and what is it that you learn from it to move to the next level? And I think I shared with you the day of the last funeral that I attended during my time off, a friend of mine who's also a therapist invited me to go see Sinbad. Love me Sinbad. But I was thinking, I don't know if I'm going to have enough energy, you know, because I was just felt like I'd been depleted and gutted. And finally I decided, yeah, I guess I'll go. What's the worst thing that could happen? I went, and I kid you not, I laughed for 2 hours straight. I laughed for 2 hours straight. And I was so hyper when I got home, I couldn't even go to sleep. And there was another young man with him, Chase Anthony, awesome young man, comedian. And it was good humor, and from what I consider good humor is one that's not negating anyone else's personal experience, but it's just looking at life and sharing just some of his things in life. And it was just wonderful. And I told Sinbad, I said, you know what? I've always loved you, but I didn't think I had any laughs in me about right now. But he didn't have to go far. He just went in there and it just pulled it out. And I felt so much better. And I think that's what got me, you know, sort of back to myself again. And it's about balance. So we laugh, we cry, but allow ourselves to go through the process. And that's it. So you follow your heart, and we heal it. And I just wish you the best with your project. I'm going to see how I can get somewhat connected with it. I can't take on another project, but how I can be of support here in Northern California. And I know you said you have someone in California, but perhaps, you know, it's in Southern California, and we are a different species up here.
We're looking for one more promoter in the California area. Only have one promoter there. But the thing is, to find the rest of the promoters, we have to spread the word. I can get a celebrity on board, that would, you know, definitely the word spread quicker. I'm an unknown comedian. I'm getting up there. More people are knowing a little bit more about me. But when you have a celebrity that's endorsing something, then, you know, the word spreads faster. That's just like somebody, a celebrity put out that challenge where the people were pouring the cold water over their head for a cause. You know, look how that spread it. I mean, that spread it like wildfire.
Right.
You know, that was a challenge.
Social media, though, there's so much access to people. I mean, look how I found you just a few weeks ago. I don't even remember where it was, but it just struck me, and I read it. It's like, oh, this sounds like something I'm interested in. So, yeah, we have as much exposure, and we just have to be willing to do, as I said, do the footwork. So now we have to let our fingers do the talking, do the walking, even though we don't have Yellow Pages anymore. I'm going to open up the lines, and I just realized I forgot to open up the chat room. So I don't know who might have been in the chat room. I will actually open that up at the same time to open the lines and see if there's anyone there. So all of our lines are now open. So if anyone has anything that you would like to say to our guests, any comments, any questions, or even to myself, go ahead now. Does anyone there want to speak to Ms. Woody or Ms. E? Okay, I guess not. I'm going to close the lines back up because that squeaking is starting to work with me.
Yeah, I know we have some bad weather here in St. Louis. So.
Do you really?
It's actually storming here. Yes, it could be a reason.
Well, I won't complain then because I have was complaining about the wind today, but it was relatively decent. So I actually went to close the window so we wouldn't get that back noise. So thank you so much for being open to sharing your story with me and with our listeners. And I just wish you the best, and we will continue to post your information up, and I'm going to see, you know, whose feather I can tickle with your project. So, and I look forward to meeting you someday, and just keep laughing. Keep laughing.
I am. I do want to close by saying this. If you're working on a project, no matter your failure, get back up. Because I failed a few times, got back up because I was determined to help people through laughter. You don't let anything stop you. Keep going. Never give up on your dreams, no matter what. Work through those failures. Because after failure comes success.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So there, you've heard it from Miss Woody herself. Give her a call. Look her up on Facebook and visit her website. I don't think you'll be disappointed. So to everyone, enjoy the rest of these summer days if you've managed to have some. And if you don't enjoy it, find something funny about it. That's because they say God definitely has a sense of humor, and neither has he forgotten us. So I'd say to all, have a great night. And if you would like to contact me, you can find me on Facebook at Miss Evelyn the Heart Lady Polk, or talk to me and let me speak. And my website is www.talktomisse.com and foracHildsHeart.org. So I say, thank you for talking to me, and do something special for a child's heart. Good night.
Heavenly Mother, I need these children, are dying at the hands of the other child. I know her heart is breaking, feel the earth is shaking, that rivers flow.